Well, thank you for joining me for this podcast on the first half of Matthew 24. I want to get right to it, so I'll be reading in the Phillips translation, starting in Matthew 24, verse 1. Then Jesus went out of the temple and was walking away. Walking away, just to remind you, from his overwhelming denunciation of the religious authorities in the last chapter, when his disciples came up and drew his attention to its buildings. You see all these? Replied Jesus. I tell you, every stone will be thrown down till there is not a single one left standing upon another. Now we, having read through chapter 23, they having heard chapter 23 at first hand, it might have seemed apparent that this was not the exact right moment for a spot of religious sightseeing of the capital city. Remember, Jesus is looking at the cross. These guys are looking at buildings. And as he was sitting on the slope of the Mount of Olives, his disciples came to him privately and said, "Tell us, when will this happen? What will be the signal for your coming and the end of this world?" And I got to say, this I find fascinating and sort of fascinatingly familiar. So here they are, sitting on the shoulder of the Mount of Olives, probably under the shade of a tree, looking across the Kidron Valley toward the city and the temple. Right next to them is the event of all human history himself, the one who has come, the bringer for all time of the kingdom age of humanity in heaven, he who makes it on earth as it is in heaven. And their questions to him? When will some events happen? When will you show up? When will heaven's ways arrive? And while I know that they are thinking toward the second coming, I don't think their questions are too terribly dissimilar to how we like to ask him, "When will things change for me? Are you really with me, Jesus? Can't you just do this one thing for me?" If the disciples had had the self-possession to actually possess the moment that they're now in, they might have wanted to use the conversation, say, this way: "Jesus, you've been mentioning being betrayed, being killed, rising from the dead. Can you tell us more about that? Or, Jesus, what would you like each of us to do for just the rest of today, even?" My friends, for us, and truly, did you know this? The greatest answer to all our theological questions and the very best way to await the second coming with great expectancy is to actively, demonstratively listen to and obey this Jesus of Nazareth today. The future is his realm. That's eternity. Our place, our time is today with him. All right, so let's get back to how he responds to those questions. "Be careful that no one misleads you," returned Jesus, "for many men will come in my name saying, 'I am Christ,' and they will mislead many." And that word that he uses there for mislead, Matthew actually uses the word planao to capture it, is actually, it's rich with visualizable meaning. Something like, do not be led from the subject. Don't be led astray. Don't be wandered off. Don't wander around in labyrinths. Which, when Jesus, during this very week, is about to call himself the way, makes the image all the more stark and stirring. He is the Christ, the way, the only way to the Father, to life, to the kingdom, to the fully unlocked meaning for what it means to be human. And so he says, looking us straight in the eye, do not be wandered off, whether that's passively or actively, onto any other way at all. His life, his way is straight and narrow. Everything else is like a wandering around in labyrinths. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but don't be alarmed. Such things must indeed happen, but that is not the end. For one nation will rise in arms against another, and one kingdom against another. And I'm going to stop there, because to me, Jesus almost sounds like he's saying something sort of like Darwinian or Nietzschean in these words. Something like struggle being our natural state as humankind. And actually, it was the English philosopher, Thomas Hobbes, who most succinctly stated that the natural condition of mankind is a state of war. But it isn't Hobbes or Nietzsche or Darwin who decided that. It was sin who decided that. Listen to Hobbes again. Life is, quote, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short because individuals are in a war of all against all. That is the nature of sin, all against all. We continue. And there will be famines and earthquakes in different parts of the world. But all that is only the beginning of the birth pangs. And what an absolutely startling thought, by the way. So, according to Jesus right here, all of human history, all the recorded progress that we have supposedly made since it's been under the curse and condemnation of sin, is only the beginning before the real thing is born. We haven't even fully begun to begin yet. To some degree, according to Jesus, we are still prehistoric. And so what will be the sign to us, the clear earthly marker that we're beginning to interact with real kingdom history? We read on. For then comes the time when men will hand you over to persecution and kill you, and all nations will hate you because you bear my name. Then comes the time when many will lose their faith and will betray and hate each other. Yes, and many false prophets will arise and will mislead many, many people. Because of the spread of wickedness, the love of most men will grow cold, though the man who holds out to the end will be saved. This good news of the kingdom will be proclaimed to men all over the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. So, just so we've got our terminology straight, the end, in this case, is absolutely synonymous with the beginning of the kingdom of heaven. And its approaching glorious triumph will be clear to us as we are persecuted, hated, handed over, killed, as many lose their faith, betray and hate each other, as false prophets arise to purposely mislead the world, as wickedness seems to reign and love to grow cold. What? This is what it looks like just before the kingdom comes in all its glory? I mean, what are we to do with this information? We are to die alongside him. We are to take the hate that he took. We are to keep this faith in him, no matter what. We are to hold out till the end, or the beginning, and to proclaim the good news to all over the world. This is what you signed up for. I guess I should say, that is, if you signed up with him, like with this man, which if you did, you already know he's totally worth it. Like any pain, any persecution, any crisis, any call. Do you know he's worth it to that degree? We continue. When the time comes, then, that you see the abomination of desolation prophesied by Daniel standing in the sacred place, the reader should note this. And yeah, let's stop there with that little aside. Because just to be clear, that was Matthew interjecting that word to us. Like, Jesus wouldn't have referenced readers when he was in the midst of chatting with his disciples in spoken form. So, Jesus was just saying something, and Matthew thinks it's particularly important for his contemporary readers to note, probably meaning that they would have had a mutual awareness of something important about those words. So let's look at those words. Like especially the abomination of desolation, for instance. In the midst of what are called Daniel's apocalyptic visions, we actually read that phrase three times, and so I'll give them to you. Here they are. Daniel 9. The people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end will come like a flood. War will continue until the end, and desolations have been decreed. He will confirm a covenant with many for one, quote, seven. In the middle of the, quote, seven, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering. And at the temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. So, like, you understand, right? No? Okay, Daniel 11. His armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. Then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. Daniel 12. From the time that the daily sacrifice is abolished and the abomination that causes desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. And you know what that means, right? Now, obviously, I'm kind of joking there with those little interjections because, again, obviously, even the people who lived back then had plenty of ideas about what all that might mean, but they didn't definitely know. And then to make historical matters maybe even a little bit more convoluted and confusing, we then read this, and this is from 1 Maccabees. On the 15th day of Kislev in the year 145, which is what we would call 167 BC, the king, and that would be Antiochus Epiphanes, built the appalling abomination on top of the altar of burnt offering. And just so you know, it was a statue of Zeus. And altars were built in the surrounding towns of Judah, and incense offered at the doors of houses and in the streets. Any book of the law that came to light was burned and torn up. But again, think about it this way. Because that happened before Jesus, and because Matthew wants his readers to note in particular what Jesus was pointing toward, like meaning in the future from himself, I think we have to keep looking onward, forward. At which point we arrive at this. This is now in AD 70, as written famously by the historian Josephus. Listen to this description. As the Roman legions drew closer to the temple, they pretended not even to hear Caesar's orders, but urged the men in front to throw in more firebrands. The rebels, and meaning the Jews there, were powerless to help. Carnage and flight spread throughout. Most of the slain were peaceful citizens, weak and unarmed, and they were butchered where they were caught. The heap of corpses mounted higher and higher about the altar. A stream of blood flowed down the temple steps, and the bodies of those slain at the top slipped to the bottom. When Caesar failed to restrain the fury of his frenzied soldiers, and the fire could not be checked, he entered the building with his generals and looked at the holy place of the sanctuary, what we would call the Holy of Holies. Now keep in mind, that is only about 40 years in the future from the day that Jesus sits on the western slope of the Mount of Olives and looks across at that temple. So perhaps the prophet Daniel's abomination of desolation is an abomination because of such physical, destructive desolation. Either way, this is what Matthew wanted his readers to note. We go on now. Then is the time for those in Judea to escape to the hills. A man on his housetop must not waste time going into his house to collect anything. A man at work in the fields must not go back home to fetch his clothes. Alas for the pregnant, alas for those with tiny babies at that time. Pray God that you may not have to make your escape in the winter or on the Sabbath day, for then there will be great misery, such as has never happened from the beginning of the world until now and will never happen again. Yes, if those days had not been cut short, no human being would survive. But for the sake of God's people, those days are to be shortened. It seems to me that the reason Matthew wanted his readers to sit up and take notice was because those days, depending upon exactly when Matthew was writing, were either nearly happening, were happening, or had happened recently enough that Matthew was saying, like, see this. Jesus knew precisely what he was talking about on this day, and for that reason, we can trust his words about his second coming, which is where he is going pretty clearly next. We keep reading. If anyone says to you then, look, here is Christ, or there he is, don't believe it. False Christs and false prophets are going to appear and will produce great signs and wonders to mislead, if it were possible, even God's own people. Listen, I am warning you. Which is Jesus' own aside, by the way, both to his friends and to us today. And what is he trying to warn us about? Again, he's talking about false Christs, false prophets, false messages that would take us away from the way. Because did you notice, again, that word mislead? Again, it's that word in the Greek, planao, that leading from the subject, leading astray, wandering off, wandering in labyrinths that we spoke of before. And if the way himself is triply concerned that we might somehow wander away or be led astray, how do you and I then redouble? Actually, we would have to retreble our seriousness about staying the course with him. Like, what's working for you right now? How are you personally enjoying focusing your heart upon him? Boy, I would love to know. Drop me a text. Shoot me a line. I would love to know this particular week that you're listening to the podcast, what is drawing your heart closer and closer to Jesus, practically speaking? I'd love to hear. We read on. So that if people say to you, there he is in the desert, you are not to go out there. If they say, here he is in this inner room, don't believe it. For as lightning flashes across from east to west, so will the Son of Man's coming be. Wherever there is a dead body, there the vultures will flock. And there's a saying of Jesus that doesn't get as much play as some of the other ones. But in reading through those last three verses this week, and though they are speaking, yes, again, to the second coming, I realize the degree to which they're actually fairly helpful to our present waiting upon him mindset. For remember, since that day will come to us like a thief in the night, we are always, every day, potentially on the cusp of his coming again. It could be like 2 minutes from now. It could be 2 years from now. It could be right now. It could be. So I want you to consider a bit of an extrapolation of these words of his, just slightly changing the context a little bit. Listen again. So that if people say to you, there he is, in some form of bodily asceticism, physical privation, self-hatred, supposedly spiritual wilderness-style living, you are not to go that way. If they say, here he is in this secret knowledge, this esoteric thought, this only if you're smart enough orthodoxy, don't believe it. For as plain as day, as glorious as the sunshine, as warm with love as a good father, is the presence of Jesus that is absolutely yours right now. For where there is not a body, where this Savior is not dead, there the body of Christ, by his Spirit, with him, must flock. My friends, as we often say on the podcast, let's enjoy this man. Thank you for listening.